It's time for a healthy breakfast.
The number one chocolate.
For two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderfully fresh.
We give thanks for a generalized kind of abundance, but we're really disconnected from the ecology that produces that food.
We know what it takes to save salmon. It's just that we lack the will to do it.
Salmon run in the area is 2 years away from extinction unless something changes really fast, which is just a devastating idea.
It's really about the way that we are human beings and the way that we're interacting with our planet.
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
And I'm Tom Philpott, food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine.
My name's Raj Patel, and I'm a professor at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs here at the University of Texas at Austin.
Stay with us.
So, Tom, what's the secret ingredient this week, and who's telling us about it?
The secret ingredient this week is traditional native foods in a time of Thanksgiving, and a particular native food, and that is salmon, which is a very, very particular fish that has been feeding people along the western coast of the United States for thousands and thousands of years, long before European settlers showed up here. And our guest today is Valerie Segrest. She is a native nutrition educator who specializes in local and traditional foods for the Muckleshoot tribe in Washington State. And she serves as the coordinator of the Muckleshoot Food Sovereignty Project. And she's the author of a 2010 book called Feeding the People, Feeding the Spirit, Revitalizing Northwest Coastal Indian Food Culture. And I wanted to just start us off talking a little bit about this amazing creature, the salmon. And so for people who don't know about it, it really is a remarkable fish. And it's easy to see why it's such a nutritional powerhouse when you get a little bit of a backstory about what it does. And so it's a fish that lives both in freshwater and in seawater. So what it does is that far upstream in coasts, and we used to have them in the northeast coast, all up the northeast coast and the Atlantic coast. They also fed tribes up there forever. But also, to this day, we have a salmon run that basically goes from Central California all the way up to Alaska. And so what the fish do is they start off spawning very far upstream, sometimes hundreds of miles away from the ocean in streams. And they swim, after they hatch, they swim with the current down to the sea. And they go out into the ocean and spend a couple of years foraging out in the ocean. They range extremely widely, and when they're out there, they're eating. They're sort of just eating stuff, and they're eating all kinds of other fish. And they are sort of a powerful, probably if you're a fish in the ocean, a very scary creature, swimming around eating other fish. They do this for about 2 years. And when they come back to the mouth of the river or stream where they came from, in extremely amazing shape. It's like they've been training, and they're packed with nutrients, which is where they get their red color. It's basically they've bioaccumulated all of this stuff that all the fish that they ate was eating, and so they get they're full of omega-3, extremely fatty fish, extremely muscular fish. And what they do when they get to the mouth is they swim upstream, up huge elevations, going against the current all the way back to where they spawn from. And they will get back to the exact place where they spawn from. And no one really exactly knows how they do it, whether it's probably a combination of olfactory sense and just this incredible sense of direction. And that's what they do. That's what they would do in a natural state. Now, obviously, they're really fragile because they need a clear path from these inland places to the ocean and a clear path back. And so development has been a major impediment to them. But it's an incredibly precious and nutritious, nutrient-packed fish, because where the fishery happens is right when they get back to the mouth of the river. So when we harvest salmon and eat it, it's at that point when it's ready for that massive run up a back uphill, back upstream to get to its spawning ground.
How different is the life of a farm-raised salmon?
Oh boy. Well, that's a whole different and very, to me, very tragic topic. That one of the things that's happening is that we've got this industrialization of salmon because it became a very popular fish, and it's by nature scarce because you can only take so much of it in these wild fisheries, and there are only so many wild fisheries left, and those wild fisheries are shrinking because of development and all the things that I said before. And so people realize that if you could get them together and sort of raise them in one place, take away this incredible journey that they have, don't let them go into the ocean and trap them in farms, you could create them very cheaply, much more cheaply than wild salmon. But, you know, it has all sorts of problems. One thing is that this journey I described doesn't happen for them. They're staying in this, like, sort of packed into this pool with a bunch of other salmon. And then basically all of the problems of factory farming on land take place in this sort of factory style salmon farming in these pens, where you get outbreaks of disease, and you get creatures like this. There's a kind of sea lice that has evolved and existed with salmon for, you know, forever. But that is sort of in balance in the wild world. But when you get them all together in one place, it makes this great habitat for the sea lice. This is just what happens in factory farming on land too. And so the response is antibiotics, pesticides, all kinds of problems like that.
Genetically modifying the salmon too.
Genetically modifying the salmon, which is in the works right now, which may be coming to a plate near you at some point. And you get, you know, these incredible sacrifices. One of the sacrifices is that salmon are a carnivorous fish. And so in order to feed them, you have to catch other you have to catch other fish. You can't just feed them corn and soybeans. And so, you know, basically you get this situation where you're going into the ocean and literally hoovering up millions and millions of pounds of small wild fish that are called trash fish. And they're called trash fish in the industry, but they're things like sardines, anchovies, really delicious, incredibly nutritious fish that we'll have to do an episode on sometime because I'm obsessed with them. They take them and they process them into pellets, and they feed the fish the pellets. And even after decades of trying to work on this, it still takes a couple of pounds of wild caught fish, to create a pound of salmon. And so it's really this kind of net loss. It represents this net loss from the ocean, and it has a massive impact on the wild fishery too, in a couple different ways. And one of them is that it drives the price down for consumers dramatically for salmon. So if you're a consumer at the supermarket aisle and you see, you know, salmon for $7 or $8 a pound that's farm raised, and wild salmon for $15 a pound, then, you know, more and more people are shifting over to wild salmon. And in this country, the last really economically massive wild salmon run is in Alaska. And Alaska, those salmon runs alone would provide 80% of the salmon that we eat in the United States. However, we end up importing the great majority of the salmon that we eat from salmon farms in places like Chile and Scotland, and most of that wild salmon that we grow, and it is incredible. I've been to Alaska. I've been to the Copper River Salmon Run in Alaska, and it is one of the best foods that I've ever put in my mouth when you're there on the ground. The great bulk of that goes to the European Union and Japan. So we're sending out this incredible resource, and we're bringing in this kind of nutritionally inferior, environmentally compromised product called farm salmon.
So we'll be talking more about salmon with Valerie Segrest, but also about Thanksgiving and her approach to this holiday. She is a Native American nutrition educator who specializes in local and traditional foods As an enrolled member of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe, she serves her community as a coordinator of the Muckleshoot Food Sovereignty Project and is the co-author of the book Feeding the People, Feeding the Spirit, Revitalizing Northwest Coastal Indian Food Culture. And we have her on the line now.
Hello. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. So, and given that we've only got you for about 20 minutes, would it be okay if we jumped in, Val?
Yeah, that's fine.
So this is our Thanksgiving issue, and we wanted to know, first of all, what do you think of Thanksgiving?
It used to really annoy me, but now I think of it as sort of a holiday that is hijacked from our culture. And it depends on the view of history that you get. But by and large, I mean, my 2-year-old this month is studying Pilgrims and Native Americans in her Montessori school. And my goodness, Thanksgiving is about giving thanks to one another. But quite often the idea of giving thanks to food is missed. And that's the culture that I come from, that we have actual ceremony around food where we take the time to sit and give praise to that particular food for giving its life in order for us to have our life.
So it sounds like Thanksgiving is the sort of thing we should be doing every day rather than
some corporatized holiday, which is the part that annoys me.
Oh,
and the fantasy history that's there.
But that's the bit that I'm confused about. Well, I want to press you a little bit on, which is the fantasy history bit, because you're from the Muckleshoot tribe, and I wonder how you unschool your daughter in the kind of, well, you know, everyone was just getting along famously across the kitchen table. What do you tell her?
Well, I'm gonna try and explain how the practice is really important, the principle that's there, but the, you know, feather hats and headdresses and those kinds of things are very they're not true. It's not that they, whether they happened or they didn't happen or however that story really did unfold, there are some speculation that it was just a story that was kind of hijacked from the Wampanoag people, who actually had 7 food ceremonies. They have, I should say, 7 food ceremonies that they practice. And maybe that was observed and then interpreted in a certain way by a group of people who came here that were very puritanical. And so the history that's portrayed may not be true, and I'm just gonna instill in her the belief of what we know here, and that is that we do honor our foods and we honor one another. Without that food, we wouldn't have an identity, and so that part is really important. But did we sit down over the table and negotiate a way of living in this world together? I don't think that's a true history.
Right. And then there were some certain problems that took place after this, you know, alleged event at the very early part of American, you know, European settlement of this continent that isn't usually discussed in Thanksgiving ceremonies in the United States today. Like, there was certain unpleasantness of sort of capture of land, genocide and things like that seem like they're a little bit underplayed in our tradition.
Definitely. Definitely. We just passed, we just got done with Columbus Day, right? That just passed and then enters November and I start getting the invite of, oh, it's time to focus on Native American Month.
Right.
And actually a lot of governments and a lot of states are looking at overturning Columbus Day. It was interesting. We also have a teenager who came home and said, can you inform me on what you think about Columbus? And we asked him, you know, what do you know about Columbus? And he said, well, I know that he killed a lot of Native people. I know that he didn't discover America because people were already living here. And so, you know, based on the list of things that he had gleaned, which I was impressed by, like, wow, you're learning that in school. I didn't learn those things in school. That was not the history I got. So I think there is a telling of our time that even just the conversation we're having right now, it's like, my mother wasn't asked these questions when I went to school. So that part is exciting, and that we're giving this opportunity to talk about history in a different way.
Well, speaking about Native foods in your part of the world, I guess one of the really sort of central ones is salmon, am I right?
Yes, that is our cultural pillar here.
So can you just talk us through the place that salmon holds in your culture and diet in that region?
Well, we know that for at least 10,000 years, our life has been organized around salmon, and it was a way of managing government around here, pre-contact, and it still somewhat is to this day. It dictates a lot of the way our life and our health is upheld. It was a food that was incredibly abundant for a very long time, and because of that, the people of the Northwest, the Coast Salish, were considered pretty wealthy. You know, we didn't have to go very far to find food, but it doesn't mean that we didn't do a lot of cultivating and land management practices. That was very inherent in our culture as well. And then you look at today, and it's quite a different time. We were predicted this year, biologists told us that if we get another 2 years of this prolonged heat, drought, weather, we could be looking at an extinction of our wild salmon population. So we're talking about a time where my elders talk about being able to walk across the backs of salmon to get across the rivers because they were that abundant when they would return. And now the sobering reality of drawing maybe 10 fish out of a spring salmon run up on the White River. And that's because we're actually where Muckleshoot is, we're placed as a terminal fishery, what they call a terminal fishery, which means we're sort of the guys at the very end of the run. So after everything's been fished from the commercial industry, the ocean-going tribes, the sports fishermen, then they come home to Muckleshoot. And so we get sort of the last of it and spend a lot of our time and resources. About $13 million a year this tribe puts into hatchery conservation, and we've been in some of our areas sitting on the beach not fishing for over 2 decades because we are that committed to conservation. So we sort of bear the burden of conservation, but that's how important it is to us.
When you give thanks for the salmon, I'm curious about what that looks like, and I mean, if the sort of mythologized idea of Native American people and the food around the table is it's something we need to move away from, what is it that we should be thinking about when for example we give thanks for salmon? When y'all give thanks for salmon, what do you do?
Here in the Northwest, we have the first salmon ceremony. And that's practiced by many tribes, and it goes along with sort of a story about how what we do on the land affects what we do in the water. So we have this sort of creation story around the ceremony about that. And basically what happens is the opening day comes for us to come out and fish, and the person that catches that first fish brings it back to the community. It's praised. Everybody sort of is uplifted and honoring this fish. That fish is then cooked, and all the bones from that fish are put back into the water. And that idea of giving back is a very, very central piece to it. and putting things back into the water. And then now we have biologists who are coming out and saying, oh, that makes sense, because when you put bones back in the water, it helps put minerals back in and alkalize it in a certain way that we actually really need, because our Puget Sound region is very is getting more and more acidified. And because of that, shellfish aren't able to form fully anymore. So it's sort of like science catches up to our tradition, I'm really interested in those points of intervention. But that ceremony is something that started from the beginning of time. And so people still are very committed to it. It's sort of like how well you honor that first fish that comes back is going to be telling of the salmon run that's to come throughout the year. Because it's not just one. We have five nations of salmon that return here every year.
I wonder if you could talk us through, in addition to this punishing drought, and I think people don't realize that the California drought is really happening all up the West Coast. The whole region is in this kind of long-term dry period. But in addition to that problem with the salmon run, what are the other challenges that you see? I mean, this is the salmon is such an amazing fish, but it requires, you know, a clear pathway and clean water from deep inland all the way out to the ocean. And what sort of challenges are messing that up right now, or in the past few years?
Right. So salmon are born in their rivers, and as young fish, they may hang out up to 1 to 2 years, but then they head out to the ocean and travel around, tonifying their bodies, collecting minerals from the ocean, eating all kinds of things, and then at some point they return to their ancestral rivers. Along that way, you've got pollution that's heading into the rivers, things like copper that are coming off of our breaks, which actually plug up their ocular senses. Oof. And salmon can smell. They say up to a mile away, they can smell a man. So they also say that they come back to the rivers based on that sense of smell. So that may be an issue, first off. Then some salmon eat more plant-based foods, and some eat more like krill, shrimp, smolts, those kinds of things, mm-hmm. Herring, that kind of stuff. And those fish that are bottom feeders are being condensed with toxins. Like Duwamish River is the largest Superfund, is a Superfund site and one of the most polluted rivers in the United States. And that's our fishing grounds, our traditionally custom fishing grounds, or one of them at least. So their bodies are being riddled with toxins, and we don't know what the effects of that truly are is in regards to them returning home. There's dams that actually in some of our chum runs get plugged up, and people are trucking loads of them around the side of the dam and up into the upper river so that they can go as far up into like 6,000 feet elevation into Mount Rainier, where they would be spawning, and that mineral rich body would feed the forest. The bears would come and get those salmon, and they'd take them out into the forest and spread the carcass around and sort of fertilize them. So that issue is a major issue, and I don't even know how far up salmon are getting these days in our tributaries. Then there's there's the commercial fishery. There's predation that's happening with introduced fish, like in Lake Washington here, where we just can't seem to get our salmon population up. We've got the locks, the Ballard locks, which have locked out salmon along the run. They open them up every year when salmon start coming up. And I don't know if anybody's ever been to the Ballard Locks, but you could go actually watch the salmon swim by in a big window. But then they enter the lake and they don't know where they go. Well, it turns out that there's high levels of predation fish that have been introduced, like pike and I think various species of trout that actually eat our young salmon. So there's so many barriers, and even if we did, and so many efforts too at the same time to try to figure out how to solve this big issue. But what I see happening is nobody's coming to the table as a collective and saying, this is what we're doing, this is what you can do for us, and this is how we can help out one another to save this fish.
So Val, you mentioned five nations of salmon, and I think that I've not heard the word nation used with respect to salmon that commonly might be thought of as species. Why did you use the word nation?
Well, my teachers tell me that, you know, we refer to things as people, as tree people, as plant people, as salmon people, and I think it's sort of an inherent, it's sort of a mindset where when you think about it as a people, as an actual living being, you think differently when you're taking the life of that thing, or when you're utilizing its resources, or when you think about how we are sharing this world with other beings. And I think it's sort of the idea of not being a dominance over the land, that how are we to live in harmony with those things? Because the land, the health of the land, the health of that tree people, that salmon nation, reflects our own health. So I think about that quite often as a health practitioner in my community, where the decline of salmon, the pollution of our rivers mirrors the addictions, the suicides, the disparities that tribal communities have live with to this day, and that all has to do with that beginning, that story around Thanksgiving and how it was told to us, right? That point of intervention, those treaty times that have happened, all of those things, pre-contact, post-contact, it all began sitting around that table.
How did the people that you are part of get last on the list in the catch? That just seems backwards to me.
Doesn't it seem like somebody told it to me the other day, like, do you know of any cattle rancher that just puts all their cows out to pasture and then never harvests any of them, just gives them all away?
Right.
People seriously are not eating salmon here. Our fishermen, it's no longer a way of life for them. We have now displaced fishermen. And, you know, for every tribe is struggling with this. It's not even just us. I don't want to make it seem like it's Muckleshoot's plight, because it's all of us.
Right.
We've got Lummi, who's dealing with Coltrane issues, and Swinomish, who has gasoline cleanups. I mean, all kinds of issues happening. But I mean, ultimately, what it's promoted is this cycle. I mean, on top of just scrutiny of research, in my opinion, it's something that's being really watched by the EPA, right? Which is, in comparison to the FDA, a pretty well-funded program, who can research water, research toxins in fish, and who come out and say to us that, you know, our fish is toxic, you can't eat it anymore. So now we have people who are in a state of fear. But the reality is nobody's testing the flame retardants and pesticide levels in that hot dog and hamburger,
right,
that we are now selling our salmon we're selling our salmon to get money to go have a clown feed our kids, and that is creating a cycle of thinking that that's a better choice, that we better not eat our traditional foods because they're actually toxic. Well, unfortunately, they're also part of natural resources and not the dominant food system, which also has its own issues of GMOs and pesticides and all of the same stuff, but just isn't as well scrutinized or advertised to us. So I just hope that people take a look at, question things, you know, question the history. Is this the true story? Help create a food system that helps people feel a sense of belonging and generosity. Those are the reasons why that first Thanksgiving really existed, if it did. That it was about teaching a certain principle of what held us together as a people and what brought a good world to exist because of the food that is laid out on the table and the respect and honoring that we have for it. It's not about, you know, the peace between one another is set up by how that food is laid out on the table, and how that food was actually grown and cultivated and harvested.
Before we let you go, I wanted you to maybe revisit a little bit about Raj's question and tell us more about some more practices that maybe reflect your perspectives and your relationship with the land and with the fish.
That, to me, is it's what we do in our everyday life. It's what we are. I think about, right now I have an 11-month-old and I'm breastfeeding, and that, you know, is the first food, right? And it occurred to me with this one that as I'm feeding her, I'm also feeding her little ovaries. I'm feeding my grandchildren. And there's this inheritance, you know, we know this in DNA, right? Like epigenetics tells us we're inheriting the historical trauma, we're inheriting the brown eyes, we're inheriting all of those things. And we also know that there is the ability to interrupt that inheritance. And what I want is for my children's inheritance to be interrupted so that we can return to a way of life that doesn't involve poorly told history, all of those things. And in order to interrupt those things, we've got to change some environmental factors. For us, what we can do with our family is make sure we eat with the seasons, because our beautiful territory provides for us what we need in order to get the attainable health to get through the year, to feed our spirit, to feed our strength, and to help feed our people. And what I do in my work is all probably something I'll never even see in my lifetime. You know, the goals that I have for my community, the hopes and dreams that I have for them to attain a healthy life. I don't know if my daughters will even receive that, but hopefully the little eggs that I'm feeding every day will see it. That's about creating this investment, thinking ahead in such a way that I'll never see the return, but my grandchildren will. I think that's a way of living on the land that we hold. We make sure to go out and harvest the nettles in the spring, harvest the huckleberries in the late summer, you know, pursue the wild game, because those are the things that help us remember who we are and celebrate the lands we come from and honor the wealth we carry. And that's the medicine that we're really needing. That's the medicine we're really after. Those are the things that held us together as a people. And then to always, always honor that food so that it will return, and it will return to feed generations to come.
Thank you so much, Valerie. This has been really great.
And
thank you so much for this opportunity. And I'm so excited to hear that you're talking about Thanksgiving in this way. I hope I did it some justice.
Thanks, Val.
All right.
Have a good day. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, with Raj Patel, Tom Philpott, and me, Rebecca McEnroy. Join us next week when our secret ingredient will be golden rice, and we'll talk with environmental anthropologist Glenn Stone. You can subscribe to The Secret Ingredient in iTunes, and if you feel it, write us a review. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, thanks for listening.
What Valerie was saying about the rituals that they have around, you know, catching the first fish and then putting its bones back into the... I mean, it makes it so much more profound because you realize that we're so disconnected from these rituals. And I think doing this show during Thanksgiving is important because it's a time when we are supposed to give thanks, you know, I mean, not just watch football or whatever, but actually give thanks. And what she said was what really caught me when she said to give thanks for the food that gave its life for you, you know, and we don't really think about that.
Yeah.
We're so disconnected. As a matter of fact, like rewarded for being disconnected at times to the food that we eat because of the way that it's produced and how horrific that is. And how can any of us sleep at night putting a piece of farm raised salmon in our mouths, you know? So
but I love that point because I think that that helps us take a step back from, you know, our relationship to food as just something you fuel your body with something that you have some emotional and spiritual connection with. But also, what I loved about what Valerie was saying is that there's an ecological story here, because when you take the first salmon and you fate it and you celebrate it, you're not harvesting the other salmon. And that's very, you know, that becomes very important in the life cycle of the salmon, as Tom was saying, because you take the first salmon, you celebrate. In the meantime, all the other salmon are going up the river and they're spawning, and you're letting that ecological function happen at the same time as your Thanksgiving function, you know, your social interaction. And that's something I think that Thanksgiving has, you know, forgotten. I mean, I think, you know, when we think about the massive slaughter of turkeys around Thanksgiving in the United States, we give thanks for a generalized kind of abundance, but we're really disconnected from the ecology that produces that food. And what's really very moving about what Valerie was saying is the Thanksgiving is about Thanksgiving for life, but also for the system that produces that life.
Yeah, and I think that here in the fast food nation, I think as problematic as Thanksgiving is and as important as it always is to bring up the sort of founding myth that Thanksgiving was garbage and that that, you know, settlers showed up and brought genocide and didn't give thanks, et cetera. It's so important to acknowledge that stuff. But it's remarkable to me that in this nation that we, you know, we don't really have a sort of unified food tradition, that we have this day every year where we are supposed to think about food and think about its ecological basis, where it comes from, how it puts us into relationship with the world. So I really believe in trying to re-enchant Thanksgiving with this knowledge, with very clear eyes on its problematic origins, but also remembering that it's great that we get together and with people that we love around a table and think and talk about food. I think reviving that, and I think we've had this sort of stale tradition of, you know, the dysfunctional family and the drunk uncle and everyone sort of being themselves in a very bad way. And I think we can move away from that and sort of revive Thanksgiving as a holiday where we do think about the ecological, social, historical basis of food.
I love that idea of re-enchanting food. And I guess I was half in jest, but I do think that this is something that should happen every day. And my understanding with what Valerie was saying is that actually for it to matter, it should matter every day. I mean, if it matters one day, it matters all of them, right?
Yeah, Raj, but I mean, we have to start one day at a time here in the United States. And, starting off with one day, I think, would be a major step forward.